All right, good morning, everyone. My name is Phil Magnus. I'm the Academic Program Director at the Institute for Humane Studies at George Mason University. I'm happy to be here to chair this first panel, which launches us onto an intellectual journey that I think will last the entire weekend as we consider the roots of modern conservatism. I'm a historian by background, so somewhat of an unusual fit for a panel that's mostly on political philosophy, although I do think that there is some intersection here, and I wanted to offer some contextualizing remarks to get us underway as we consider three figures that I think will come up at many points over the course of the weekend, as they should be, as intellectual forebearers for what we consider conservatism today, and that is Adam Smith, Edmund Burke, and Frederick Bastiat. The interesting thing about all three of these figures is they were all known in some capacity or another in their own times, in their own context, as liberals. Now, I mean classical liberals, not the modern sense, thankfully. But nonetheless, our story begins in a political framework that I'm going to actually date to 1782, July 1st, 1782, which is, actually, if you know your English history, that is the date that the Marquess of Rockingham, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, unexpectedly died of influenza. Interesting thing about Rockingham is he was himself the intellectual center of gravity of English Whig liberalism in the late 18th century, had been a member of the opposition of the British Parliament at the time of the entire American Revolution, essentially as a force that had advocated for making peace with the colonies and eventually advocated for a peaceful separation with the colonies, who came into power in 1782 as the Prime Minister with an appointment that carried with him a series of additional figures that we know of today for their influences, more so on the right than on the left. One of those would have been his secretary, Edmund Burke. Another, a follower and a dedicated Rockingham Whig, according to his biographer and several who knew him, Adam Smith, had been a thorough supporter and component of this ascendancy. But July 1st, 1782, when Rockingham unexpectedly passed away, it caused a major disruption that set into course the events of an unraveling of something that had become an emergent classical liberal order in the British parliamentary system. Two of the three figures we'll consider today were at the forefront of those discussions. First, I want to turn my attention to Adam Smith. Interestingly enough, Smith was a quintessential academic, and by that I mean absent-minded professor of notorious propriety, but nonetheless a politically engaged one, but politically engaged in a sense that is somewhat enigmatic today. His friends called him a warm supporter of the Rockingham Whigs. Indeed, Edmund Burke himself called him a thorough and loyal Whig in his politics. Smith's support on the occasion of the death of the Marquess of Rockingham sided with Burke and Burke's own intellectual follower, at the time protege, the Whig statesman Charles James Fox, in protest over King George's more conciliatory appointment to replace Rockingham's Prime Minister, Lord Shelburne, and resigned in protest 4 days later as an exit from the government, out of a belief that a backtracking was occurring of sorts from the previous colonial policy of making peace with the Americans. Nonetheless, Smith engaged politically on that side of the divide, which I would argue is the beginning of an unraveling of that era that converts and forces an upheaval in the British parliamentary order. Nonetheless, interestingly enough, Smith was engaged politically. He knew the replacement of Rockingham, Lord Shelburne, dating back many years. We, in fact, have a story that accounts a 1761 journey to London in which Adam Smith accompanied a young member of Parliament at the time, Lord Shelburne, and proceeded to lecture and harangue him over the course of the journey on the principles of free trade to such an extent that by the time that they arrived before the parliamentary session, Lord Shelburne had abandoned prior instances of mercantilism and embraced a free market economy. Nonetheless, Smith himself broke on this occasion over a very different form of political engagement, and that is the question of the colonies. So one of the unifying themes I do want to stress today is that there are some underlying principles that I think connect these figures. First, economic liberalism. And economic liberalism, by that I mean free market economic liberalism, not the modern control and command economies that we tend to associate today with that particular term. Smith is first and foremost known as the father of free market economics, the father of the discipline of economics. Yet, interestingly enough, Smith's legacy in his own time was as a moral philosopher. And one of the great intricacies of history, and in some respects tragedies, is the overshadowing effect that his book, The Wealth of Nations, had on his further legacy, including what I would consider, and I think some here may agree with me on this, his superior book, which is The Theory of Moral Sentiments, that was published some decade and a half prior to the emergence of The Wealth of Nations, as a work of political philosophy and moral philosophy. Nonetheless, we know that there is a connection between the two in the way that Smith engaged them. I'd argue a second principle that unites these figures is anti-state skepticism, or skepticism of government authority. We see that first and foremost represented in their revolutionary stances with the United States. Third, and perhaps less known of these three figures, they were all in various respects anti-slavery men, which is an interesting emergence from that point in history. We don't traditionally think of anti-slavery as being a core component of at least modern political philosophy, but it is a uniting force in the sense that Smith is one of the first figures that formalizes an anti-slavery political economy in his work. I want to next turn to our second figure of consideration, and that is, of course, Edmund Burke. Burke himself is a correspondent of Smith. He was, in his own political career, originally the secretary of the Marquess of Rockingham, who came to political power as a leading figure in the Whig Party. Interestingly enough, he is the most conservative of the liberal faction in that time, especially in the company of his protege, Charles James Fox, Sheridan, other figures at the time that pushed the more anti-state direction of their particular line of argumentation in a more aggressive fashion than Burke would go. Interestingly enough, Adam Smith himself would have remarks on Burke. He said, and I quote, "Burke is the only man I ever knew who thinks on economic subjects exactly as I do, without any previous communication having passed between us." Well, they later had communication between the two of them, though interestingly enough, Burke himself never truly advanced Smithian political economy from the floor of the House of Commons in the way that some of his associates did. Smith's legacy in terms of the Wealth of Nations is in some respects bequeathed to us from an incident that happened in 1784 when Burke's protege, Charles James Fox, decided to enter into a budget debate and made reference to the principles of political economy recently articulated by Professor Adam Smith from up in the north, up in Scotland. Smith, at the time, heard this speech had been made. It was announced in the papers. He left us a legacy out of that speech because he wrote his publisher at the time and said this book that had been out for 8 years at that moment, it had run through a press run of maybe 1,000 copies. He said that it's been mentioned in Parliament. You ought to up the press run, put it back into circulation, therefore bequeathed us through this liberal political tradition the modern version of the Wealth of Nations that came out of that that era. Yet Burke himself never truly engaged political economy as a driving issue of his own political career. We do know that Burke's sympathies did lie in a thoroughly Smithian direction. The one pamphlet I would call attention to was actually prepared, interestingly enough, after Burke broke from his prior Whig political tradition and sided with the somewhat cranky Toryism of William Pitt the Younger through the French Revolutionary period, a pamphlet known as Thoughts and Details on Scarcity, which is classic political economy in the Smithian sense. Interestingly enough, it comes from the height of what has since become referred to as Pitt's Terror, the fundamentally illiberal moment of reactionary responses to the French Revolution that are birthed out of the warfare state that emerges in the early 1790s. Nonetheless, this is published in 1795. It, too, may be a forgotten classic in many respects in the sense that I would consider it among, if not the greatest, of Burke's works, rather than any of the speeches or pamphlets before Parliament or even his celebrated Reflections on the Revolution in France that emerge as the center of his political order. Yet, nonetheless, we know Burke is a champion of liberty. In fact, a dedicated champion who frequently speaks in terms that we would consider symptomatic of a modern libertarian outlook. To quote Edmund Burke on the subject, of all the loose terms in the world, liberty is the most indefinite. Whenever the separation is made between liberty and justice, neither is, in my opinion, safe. And thus he saw his own perspective in the political realm as a preserver, as a protector of these principles, these symbiotic principles of liberty and justice. As we turn to our second paper, Steve Ely astutely notes, and will be making this point, that Burke exists in many varieties. I would contend that there are, in fact, two distinct historical Edmund Burkes that exist in his own lifetime, the precise dividing line occurring on or about May 6, 1791, which is the moment that he crosses the aisle and breaks with the Whig Party over the French Revolution. This is, of course, the day that Burke also has his breach with his disciples, Fox and Sheridan, interestingly enough, on a bill about French Canada, the political disposition of Quebec, which provided an occasion to make a proxy entry on the French Revolution. His turn actually shocked the conscience of many liberal admirers, including the poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge, who was prompted in response of capturing the mood of the moment through an imagined speech of the Goddess of Liberty, facing her former disciple, Edmund Burke, in stern lecture to the wayward statesman. Great son of genius, sweet to me thy name, ere in an hour with altered voice thou bad'st oppression's hireling screw rejoice, blasting with withered spell my laureled fame, yet never, Burke, thou drankest corruption's bowl. This is a retort from a self-identified liberal who has emerged in the Burkean system of political thought. Burke, interestingly enough, never repaired with his old friends of the Whig Party, whose political errors, I would argue, more strongly carry forth both Burkean and Smithian political economy today. Nonetheless, Burke's liberal statescraft influenced the generation to come. Coleridge himself, after giving that stern lecture in poetry, would nonetheless append his missive 3 years later, referring to his old hero, Burke. Burke, whose speeches he memorized in childhood, "Peace be upon his spirit. When it departs from us, this severest punishment I wish upon him, that he may be appointed under porter to St. Peter and be obliged to open the gates of heaven when Brissot, Roland, Condorcet, Lafayette, and Priestley arrive." Nonetheless, Burke's political errors and legacy do carry forth both in these figures and then the direct split that occurred to Toryism among the heirs of Pitt the Younger. We turn next in our story to France, in particular the longest of the three traditions that we will consider today, the French classical liberal tradition. French classical liberals, as I know very well, are very hard to come by in this modern day of Thomas Piketty and such likes that tend to dominate that realm of political thought, but nonetheless, a vibrant tradition emerged at the very same event that caused the tension in the historical Burke, the French Revolution, including some of the figures named and enlisted by Coleridge and other conversants of the Whig liberal order of the late 18th century. French classical liberalism persists in a somewhat forgotten but existent French liberal tradition that David Hart will provide us a journey through. I'd first call attention to a student of the Marquess de Condorcet, and a contemporary conversant of our own Thomas Jefferson, and that is the Comte de Tracy, who provides the first intellectual articulation of the principles of liberal political economy that initiates essentially what is known as the French liberal school of thought. More directly, we know this through its inheritances of Jean-Baptiste Say, the liberal disseminator of our original figure of consideration, Adam Smith, and through that, a lineal descendant of both Burke's Whigs and Smith's political economy, both on the French side of the channel, Frederick Bastiat, and Bastiat's own frequent conversant, Richard Cobden, the free trade liberal statesman who claimed himself a lineage as well to Burke and Smith, and carried forth his most famous act, the repeal of protectionism in 1846, with the removal of the corn law barriers. Free trade, interestingly enough, is an issue that unites these three figures, even though Bastiat emerges into his own some two generations after both Smith and Burke have died. Bastiat is in many respects the most prodigious and prolific of the writers of the series. I think David mentioned to me that he penned over the course of a short writing career of only 5 years before his untimely death in 1851, I believe, a volume and canon that consisted of what will eventually be six works translated through a process that David is currently working on, several thousand pages, many of which have yet to even make it into English. Nonetheless, Bastiat becomes his own figure as the champion of mid-19th century free trade liberalism. This is an exercise in a historical assault on the very first and original form of central planning, that is the protectionist political order that has emerged concurrently with it out of mercantilism. I would argue even so far that protectionism in its forms that were being articulated in the mid-19th century were proto-Soviet in some of their designs, in the sense that they are attempting to carry forth the original iteration of command and control price setting through a centralized mechanism of targeting. A collision course, of course, emerges between the state and the old adversary of state action, including in the American traditions of Jefferson that are inherited in many ways directly from their British forebears and progeny, and another force that had been emergent at that time. We've unfortunately had to frequent the room named after him, Alexander Hamilton, over the course of the session. But Hamilton emerges, and his heirs emerge in the American sense, as the primary defenders of the assault upon this free trade, free economy liberalism, and I'd argue also with that anti-intervention liberalism that is emergent at mid-century, to the point that the project initiated by Cobden and carried forth by Bastiat runs headfirst into a collision in the American sense with an emergent protection order. So where does that leave us? Amidst a contested tradition of these three seminal figures, yet one that captures a full breadth of intellectual vibrancy that I hope to bring forth in our discussion today. With that, I'd like to turn over our panel to our first speaker, Dr. James Otteson, who is the Executive Director of the BB&T Center for the Study of Capitalism, as well as the recently appointed Thomas W. Smith, Presidential Chair of Business Ethics at Wake Forest University. Dr. Otteson has been named the inaugural occupant of this new position in business ethics. He is also one of the preeminent political theorists of Adam Smith, including Smith's moral philosophy and where it unites and intersects with his political economy. His most recent books are The End of Socialism and What Adam Smith Knew, both of those published in 2014. And some of you may also know him. He delivered the inaugural Leonard Liggio lecture for the Atlas Society approximately 2 years ago when we kicked off that event. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. James Otteson, who is going to walk us through some of the contested legacies of Adam Smith's career.